start to happen, you know. I'll probably do some more. You know, there's some people over in St. Leonard's, where in Hastings, where Samantha is, that are quite into this sort of stuff. But you know what it's like? People don't really want to play. It's sort of so funny. You know, I'm dying to play with other people, but they sort of don't do it, you know. So,
you know,
when the time feels right, I'll do another one. I'll definitely keep you posted, man.
No, that's funny. And I think sometimes that's what the best artwork comes from, is from a sense of play. Like, oftentimes when I'm working on a piece, I'll accidentally do something to it, and it ends up, you know, really giving it a new life of its own.
Well, what might be good, you know, we've kind of sort of touched on the idea before. If we chose a sort of time, maybe sort of Midsummer's Night or something like that, and we could, or some special conjunction time or something, and we could do something, you know, like we talked about Alchemy at the Heart of the Earth. If we could drop something like that in, you know, I think we're fully capable of trying, you know, we're fully capable of experimenting and sort of just seeing what, you know, it's going to be, interesting, if nothing else, you know, we can tie something in, you know, if we could, you know, I'd love the sync people to sort of do their stuff coordinated around the States, and if we could tie it in with some people in England as well, you know, sort of worldwide magic is what we try to do. And I just don't know what could come of it, but it could be fun just to play, you know, just to play at it.
Yeah, and I think
there might be some worldwide magic this summer. I think Alan is coming to Boise, and we're going to try and get as many people to come up into the woods with us and have, like, spirited and lively conversations. You're welcome to come if you want to travel.
Yeah, airport. I doesn't agree with me all the time, but I'll tell you what I would like is, if you guys get together, I could sync in with you on Skype or whatever, even on a video link, and we could sort of, you know, we might be able to sort of tie in something somewhere that sort of, I don't know, it'd be fun to see you guys sort of partying anyway, you know.
Hopefully Justin's going to be there as well.
Yeah, I would certainly try to get there. It's been funny. I know I mentioned this to you on Facebook, Mark, but that you contacted me through the Red Ice thing, and then like a week ago, I had that band called Hollow Moon contact me, and it turns out they're also from your neck of the woods or from Brighton area.
Yeah, and have you seen the post that's just come onto the SyncBook page?
Yeah, about that. I saw that. I didn't really read while we were talking, but you mentioned like the Hollow Moon thing.
Well, yeah, the guy above said he's, you know, he's just watching Hollow Moon, and I thought, hey, man, this is something else, you know? It's a bit of a close one, isn't it? And, you know, biggest super moon this Sunday, Saturday or something. It's, anyway, it's an interesting possibility.
Yeah.
When you said about the kaleidoscopes, I didn't want to interrupt you because we were running out of time, but what's amazing to me is I've been trying... You know, I don't know, I guess sometimes I feel like putting it into words, a lot of this stuff, it so comes close to, you know, you get dangerously close to creating dogma once you put something into words. But that's my, you know, that's my medium, so I have to kind of find a way to make it work. And I'm trying to be as free-flowing as you're able to be, but at the same time trying to put these things into words. And a phrase that I keep coming back to, and I've written probably three times in the last few weeks, is this idea that to use, you know, this idea of synchromysticism or sync goggles, it means to look at the world with this kaleidoscopic view, that you're looking at the world through a kaleidoscope where you're taking all the different perspectives into consideration and trying to filter out what, you know, what you can take out of it. And I loved the idea of you comparing kaleidoscopes and then making goggles for people to walk around with. I just love that we're both kind of envisioning something similar.
It's a bit of a crazy one, and I don't suppose it'll happen, but yeah, it's it's interesting. You know, the guy that invented the kaleidoscope, I can't, if you Wikipedia, you'll find it. He actually wrote a book about practical magic back in the 1840s as well. So, you know, these science guys were sort of working with the sort of primacy of elemental understanding as well as sort of the scientific paradigm. But to the sort of limitations of language and the spoken word, I kind of got to agree with you again, Alan. It's sort of, it's so limiting. We've got 26 letters in the alphabet that we spin around on our tongues. And it is limiting. And, you know, maybe the odd man, you know, like Shakespeare comes along and can sort of paint a picture that's sort of that's far more vibrant than the normal language allows. And it's almost as if we need a new language. We, you know, the part of the alphabet is limiting in its structure as well, just as the geometry and the trigonometry of the world and the architecture of the world is limited in its way. It's almost time for a new form of communication that's sort of not predicated on these traditional methods, but is of now, a sort of zeitgeist language, something of that sort that might be some alchemical manifestation coming from the source. It's a bit too sort of far off, but I think it's sort of, it's something like that's coming, you know, and
yeah,
it could manifest in the form of a type of telepathy or something, whereby we communicate with thoughts rather than with words, so we can transmit to one another without the sort of limitations of our tongues. It's something like this, and Samantha, my wife, sort of suggests that the sort of the, you know, the progression through mobile phones to texting to email to Facebook and Twitter and things, all these sort of methodologies are a precursor to either refinding or discovering for the first time telepathy of some sort, where the sort of verbal language is kind of outmoded as sort of smoke signals almost, but perhaps it might be smoke signals, I don't know, you know.
No, that is I'm right there with you. I think you mentioned watching the Alan Moore documentary, and he has some interesting ideas about language doubling and doubling and doubling at a quicker and quicker rate. I know Robert Anton Wilson called it like the jumping Jesus theory of, like, if you took the time from Jesus to now, and that was one Jesus worth of information. And then that doubled again, so you have two Jesuses of information. So it's been kind of, whether synchronistic or other, or just coincidental, that we're getting into that phase of where language is doubling and doubling and doubling. And that might be what it is time for, you know, to evolve to some kind of almost telepathic state.
We need you guys to come up with a new shape. I'm tired of all these circles and squares and triangles. You got to come up with a new... I'm kidding.
No, I think to just put a far out idea out there, like I've had kind of a vision of, you know, like there is something powerful about working with the geometries because they are part of the underlying kind of fabric of what we're living in right here. So one of the most basic kind of sacred geometry things is having six circles around one circle. And so it creates kind of like this hexagonal matrix that I think kind
flower
of makes
of life,
the vacuum.
Right?
Yeah, like flower of life. It makes like the vacuum of space. Kind of the far out idea is that, you know, in this reality, we have six circles fit around one. I've almost seen in like a parallel dimension that seven, you know, like in our most neighboring universe, seven circles would fit around one. And then in the neighborhood of that, eight circles would fit around one, if that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it would kind of give birth to like a whole new shape and structure of life. You know, like you have in ours, you know, water is hexagonal and we're kind of five-sided with five fingers and five toes and five extremities to some extent. And you can almost just imagine what life forms or trees or plants or planets or things like that would kind of arise from even just having the bent, from our perspective, bent like fabric of space to where seven circles fit around one. Just kind of interesting idea to think of. Does that make sense, or is it?
It does make sense. It does make sense. It kind of takes us back to sort of creation almost. I think that idea that that's the way it is, and perhaps that phase of creation is coming to an end, and a new phase of the creation, you know, the evolutionary or creationary process is leading to something of that sort. Because just because, you know, in the sort of the form of the Tesseract and that sort of thing, that it's only a three-dimensional limitation that holds us in that construct that allows us or conditions us to believe that only six circles can fit round in that way. But it's not, it doesn't have to fit in that way. It doesn't have to be that way. It's unraveling all those thought processes and taught paradigms over thousands of years that has led us to this limitation, I think, Justin. So I see what you mean. I feel what you mean. It's something like that, you know?
Yeah. At one point you talked about doing like 1,000 drawings leading up to, and I think it's important not totally to get caught up in number or strictly quantity, but I was just curious about that. Are you still like, is that kind of an aim?
Well, yeah, that was a sort of, yeah, it might have been a bit over grandiose on my part, but it could end up with that sort of number. I'd sort of tend to do sort of half a dozen a week, and I might not do that by the end of this year, which is my sort of goal. But it's not a matter of number as such. It's a matter of evolving through doing the process. It's like having a garden, I guess, and kind of spending as much time as you can in the garden to make the garden as beautiful as possible and to grow the plants that you want to grow and see the seeds that you want to, that you've planted fully manifest. So, you know, 1,000 might have been a slightly apocryphal number, but it might be the process. But, you know, I don't count anymore. And as I say, I don't even look at them once I've drawn them. I put them away and they just sort of sit in a folder and, you know, one day they'll come out again, you know, but yeah. I don't have the sort of wish to pull them out and work with them. But, you know, the process of working with the drawings has led me to the jewels that I told you about, and the sort of the crystals and forms that I found, and the treasures I found as a result of that, and working at the spring, Justin. You know, that's been, you know, such a process for me, man. Not only with my son, but for myself, and understanding, you know, the capacity of water, the nature of water. And progressively I've taken precious stones I've found to that spring, put them in, and then 2 weeks later I found a better stone, and then a better stone. Yes. So it kind of works towards that end as well, you know? Yeah, I've got no explanation or understanding of the actual process because I'm so immersed in it, but I'm lucky that I can immerse myself in the process and see what the process brings to me, you know, rather than having to sort of try and manifest things or work with things. But increasingly, you know, people wanted to come up there and do stuff and, you know, do their whatever, their rituals, and that's perfect for me, you know. That's what this is all about. And as it's on an old church site, it's kind of it's part of it is freeing that the sense of captivity and capping that the church has put on a natural for centuries, maybe, well, at least 1,000 years. There's been a church there since the 9th century. So there could have been things there before then. You know, in my sort of, when I go there in a sort of alchemical state, I can sense that there's Roman and pre-Roman, there's probably caves under that place somehow. And I met with an old friend of mine, a real sort of wild old hippie, you know, and he wants to come down there and use his kind of third eye to explore the place. And, you know, that it's kind of revealing what's been hidden. You know, there's so much stuff coming up in the world now, isn't there? You know, discoveries and, you know, of free energies and, you know, pyramids and, you know, all this stuff's coming up, man. And there's something big's happening, you know, but I don't know what role you or I have to play in it, except to sort of surrender to it and work with it.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, that's a lot of great stuff. I was going to add in the beginning of that, that I think that's something kind of beautiful about your work. It reminds me of the Tibetan like sand paintings. And I think those are, to me, some of like the most beautiful artistic expressions happening on this planet, of where they painstakingly make the big mandalas with the sand, and then as soon as it's done, they kind of wipe it away, and then they'll go offer it to the river and put it in the water and stuff like that, kind of as a blessing. But I think it's something kind of, it speaks to writing like in the book of life, rather than, you know, like making something and trying to hold on to it, that once it's completed and once it's fully made, it kind of leaves an imprint on the fabric of the universe, and then, you know, they wipe it away to, you know, accept the impermanence of things, and then give it as an offering. And I just wanted to add, I'd be curious if, I don't know if you do dowsing or anything like that, but that would be kind of an interesting thing to do out at the spring area.
Yeah, I'm up for anything. You know, I'm kind of, every time I go, I normally go up once a week on a Sunday morning, and, you know, because Samantha and I live in separate towns, you know, we live about 20 miles from each other. And so I go up there, and every time I try and engage on a different level with it and learn more about these natural processes, but I'm kind of almost at pains, almost sort of over-restrict myself by not learning anything other than what I'm shown to learn, and try not to take strictures of doctrines and dogma and expect them to work within that paradigm. It's sort of it's almost a way of kind of manipulating it that's kind of sort of contra to the natural earth flow. You know, it's almost sort of setting a limitation on what the potential is by restricting in that way. But you know, hopefully the more people that come up there, and quite a few people do go up there now, they're sort of learning about things, and they always share their ideas and thoughts with me, and it kind of gives, it's almost other people's experiments of teaching me what I need to know about the place, and not about the place, but about water in general. And, you know, and back to you with your art, man, you know, it's, you know, what you're doing, I don't know if you realize how powerful it is, how overwhelmed I was when I first saw that picture. You know, I saw something of the highest order, man, of the, you know, and I've been around sort of temples and stuff for most of my adult life, and you know, you're on another level. You're gifted on it, you know? And you know, the more you can do, the better, you know, the more that you can do, the better for this world. You know, the world's a better place for that sort of art, isn't, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I appreciate the kind words in regard to it. It's kind of funny to give a little backstory on the Buddha piece that you're talking about. It was while I was in school, and you know, while I was in college for design, and they would give us certain assignments, you know, to design a poster or things or this or that, and I was getting a little bored with like the assignments they were doing, and they were having us design like some infographic, like that was kind of the assignment. Like, so lots of people were designing maps or things like that. And I was like, well, what do I want to design a map of, you know, like, can I design a map of the whole cosmos, you know, like, and I actually did it, that piece, all in one night. I was able to put that all together in one night. But it had quite a funny reaction because it is kind of rather psychedelic, and it was one of those moments where the artwork was just totally flowing through me and everything was just coming out right as it was supposed to. But the reaction from the teacher and everyone was kind of funny the next day, because it's like a 6-foot tall poster of, for those listening, of Buddha with like a galaxy at the top, and it kind of goes through the progressive fractal levels of the kind of spiral patterns repeating themselves down to then like a subatomic level. But it was rather humorous, the reaction from the teacher the next day. They're like, what the hell is this? Like, what is this? They like kind of didn't know how to take it.
Listen, I've got to go soon, man. But what, the day after, it's Tuesday today here in England, and I suppose it is there too. On Thursday, I'm going up to the Alchemy exhibition at the Science Museum, and I'm meeting John O'Brien, who's also on the Sync collective group, and I'm meeting Obi is called. I'm meeting him there as well, and I had a very interesting time with him last. I only met him last Halloween down at Avebury, which is a stone circle, and spent 3 days down there. Never met him before, and we got on, you know, we were sort of brothers the moment we met each other. And I'm meeting him there on Thursday, sort of, we're meeting outside the museum at midday in the centre of London, you know. And what I'll do is I'll make a full record of it, and hopefully there'll be some images that will trigger something, you know, with regard to the Ripley scroll and all that stuff that we chatted about.
Yeah,
you
know, that's pretty incredible.
Know what the exhibition's going to have on display, but, you know, I'll take as many photographs as I can, and I'll send them across to you privately, and, you know, there will be something that's going to trigger something between us. You know, it was so synchronistic, that whole, you know, that you showed me that drawing that you were creating at the time, and you know, with the Ripley image. So there's going to be something that's of such value to you and I in terms of the alchemical process, and I, you know, the alchemical process is an internal thing for me. It's nothing to do with externality at all, you know. It's kind of, yeah. I think that's a real sort of you know, false flag for people to think that that's what's important about the process, you know.
Yeah, it throws the greedy ones off the trail, and that is like the red herring of the fish dragged across, and people are like, oh, gold, you know, like we could make gold with this.
One, two, three, one, two, three, oh.
Making gold, so I have like this burning question now. It's, where is the synchromistic art opening, like, gallery show going to happen? Is it San Francisco, or is it New York, or is it London? So I'm seeing this fabulous exposition of your work, Justin, Mark's work, maybe David Plate, like a synchromistic art show.
That would be.
There's actually, it's interesting enough, one of the guys on the Synchromistic page, I can't remember, one of the guys put a link up about an exhibition that's happening in Manhattan at the moment. It's called Sigils and Signs, or Signs and Sigils. It's run by a woman who runs a blog, a Phantasmagoria or something. If you look up, it's on the Synchromistic, you know, the page we're all on.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
I looked at that Signs and Sigils things, and, you know, there's some pretty amazing stuff going. It's in Manhattan, so I presume Alan will be able to see it. So
yeah, it's in Brooklyn. If you'd like, I can go by and take some photos. I've actually looked at the page. It looks really interesting.
we might be able to sort of work in, because she seems to be a bit of a powerhouse in as much as she's brought these people together. So she must have a sort of fair connectivity within the scene, if you like, to sort of bring people together and manifest things. But, you know, if there would be something we could do, you know, virtually or in real time, you know, that would be amazing, you know, as well as kind of meeting everybody and having, you know, having a party as well. You know, that could be fantastic, you know, and that would be a manifestation rather than the sort of in the real world, rather than on the, you know, the etheric, not the etheric, the sort of digital, you know, this kind of computer interface, you know, that would be fantastic to draw it together in some way, you know.
Sure, it gives us an excuse to go back to New York too, right?
Yeah. Can I make a proposal?
Yeah, I do.
Mark, if you're really interested, you know, compile like 10 images. I don't know how many images, but pick like a few images that you really think speak to your artwork. Maybe Justin wants to do it. Maybe, like you said, like Doug said, maybe DVD Platypus wants to do it. But like, if I could hand her a CD or something with images on it, and sort of, I could just walk over there. I mean, it's really close, and I could go over there and be like, "Hey, this is great, and check it out. Here's some other artists doing something similar," or whatever you'd want to do. I have no problem passing that along.
Well, I've actually emailed her and got in touch with her, saying how impressed I was with her, and she's kind of been back in touch, and we've sort of said hi, you know, only a couple of emails. But if you know, it might be great for you to introduce yourself to her with regard to the book as well, because I think, you know, if you gave her a copy of the book or whatever, I think it could well trigger something else that's dormant within her in terms of her sort of networking capacity within the world she knows and the world you know. And so I think that you guys, you and her, should actually, I think there's something to come from the two of you coming together. Whether that involves Justin and I and David or not is kind of secondary at this time. I think you've got a real opportunity to sort of hook up and see, you know, it might come to nothing. But my impression was, you know, anyone that can pull something together like yourself, like, I can't remember her name, the girl that's a woman that's put on this show, when people that actually do things come together, sparks can really fly. You know, it's like, you know, in essence, I'm a producer, not a facilitator for meetings and stuff. You know, I'm kind of like, I'm sort of, you know, that's more my level of engagement, even though I'm quite happy to chat. But in terms of sort of manifesting things on a physical level, producing a book or an exhibition, you know, I just kind of like run a mile, man. You know, it's sort of like, you know, I'm sort of like, no responsibility, I can't do it. But I, you know, it could be that if you say we've chatted and, you know, brought in other ideas, it could be a great opportunity to hook up with, you know, another group in another sort of collective, if you like, you know. And it will be a great show, I'm sure. You know, there's going to be some pretty far out stuff in there as well.
Oh, absolutely. Just the website, I saw some of the stuff, and it looks beautiful.
Could you share that with me real fast, Alan?
Sure, I'll find it here. So the group that we're all in together on Facebook is called Kitchen Sink.
And I would interject that this is the cutting edge of synchromysticism collaboration right now. That as far as witnessing in real time these minds coming together and inspiring one another, and the diversity of the individuals involved in this is incredible. And so this is a fabulous group.
I'm really happy with this. This group was actually made because Mark Golding should get a lot of credit for it. Is Mark Golding contacted me and said, "Hey, you have all these people. Is there a way we can sort of bring these minds together and try and work on projects?" And I was like, you know, I was like, wow, I'm kind of busy. I don't know how I would even begin to, do I build a forum? How would I even make that happen? And then I was like, I could just make a Facebook group, and it's a place to start. And I just sort of whipped it up and was like, all right, let's see what comes out of it. And oh, it's been really impressive how people have responded to it.
Yeah, it could be that the girl that's a girl woman that's facilitated the exhibition might want to join the group as well and invite her the people that have contributed to her exhibition to join in as well, because I think they're all going to be pretty much of a like mind. You know, there's going to be some real freaks as well as some real sort of down-to-earthers as well. But that's a great mix, and it could be, Alan, the fact that you published the Sync book is kind of like is such a sort of milestone, if you like. You know, it's such a milestone. I don't know if you quite realise sort of what you captured a zeitgeist, something in there. You know, I mean, the fact that sort of Heinrich's picked up on it is, you know, sort of says a lot, doesn't it? But it's the more people and the more people that could join, the chance of someone saying, "Yeah, I've got an idea. Let's see if we can get behind this," is will increase. You know, the chances of something that's worthwhile for us all. You know, not a short term thing, but a long term collaboration of energetic and expression. That, you know, we might turn out to be, you know, really useful resource for the world. You know, in our weird, wacky way, man. You know, in our unconventional way, we could set some sort of, you know, trajectory for the world in, you know, maybe just with limited circles, but hey, you know, words and art influence, you know, we can
absolutely,
we can do it, man, you know.
The so Doug, the website is observatoryroom.org, and the woman I believe Mark is referring to is probably Pam Grossman. It says Pam Grossman is an independent curator and lifelong student of magical practice and history. She is the creator of Phantasmophile. Yeah, okay. Pam Grossman.
So, but, Mark, ahead. I don't want to cut anything short. You mentioned you might have to leave, or...
Yeah.
I guess we've been recording this as well. I don't know if there's anything you want to add for kind of wrapping up on this end or whatnot.
What I'll do is I'll just read you a poem I wrote.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, it's called Mandala Sun. My messenger of painted air has alchemized a signet key that opened up the spiral stair upon this golden dawn. Thus captured upon inner eyes, the sun's mandala brings surprise of recognition to the child within. Kaleidoscopic magic light that activates the third eye's sight and raises love to hold entranced our lover's sense in paradise we danced. The glowing power of truth and light, expressions of the goddess, might seduce those held in fear of death, anticipating life's last breath. So, exhale and breathe her sensual form that balances both sun and moon in velvet hues that capture you, embraced and warmed in swoon. Her flames are lithe, with tendrils reaching deep inside. They coil, entwine, and supplicate the holy wine you proffer her. Through honeyed gauze, her light afire, I witness open-eyed the pyre, but earn the wisdom she inspires to ease my soul. That's it.
We'll be right back. pieces and go home.
If everyone wrote something, you know, if we all, I'd say 10 pages, we could put together a great idea. And it kind of snowballed until we ended up with 26 authors, but it's, you know, by necessity, not at every, there's just too many wonderful people out there for me to have everybody. But,
well, it's a shame because it's like...
Wait. Yeah. Pause. What I was going to say, actually, is just to say that, you know, we talked about doing a second volume of this. I don't know a time frame on it at the moment, but I've talked to a few people. People contact me saying, hey, you know, why didn't you have this person in the book? Why didn't you? It's like, at the time, I didn't know everybody, and I'm sure I still don't know everybody, obviously. But if that sounds at all intriguing to you, let me know. And when I have a little more information, pretty soon I should, I'd love to send you the info, and if you're interested, I'd love to have you part of it.
Sure. I mean, I don't fit very well into any category, which is, I quite like that, actually. I break rules.
This was a whole book of people who break rules.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
And that is one of the most enjoyable things about this kind of work, is how many rules you can break.
If you go to thesyncbook.com, you'll see what we did, and the four of us on this call that you're speaking to were all part of the book. Justin designed the website and the book cover. Jason and I worked on editing the book. Douglas was instrumental in helping get some of the people involved. So it was definitely a group project, a labor of love. But
the radio shoot, too, 42 minutes, grew out of the book. So the whole point was we started by interviewing the various authors about their piece in the book, and so it was a way that we could promote the book, but then get to know these different people that we don't really know that well. And then the show has kind of grown, you know, as we've worked our way through the book. Now we're like reaching out to people that we were familiar with their work, but we're intrigued by, you know, who they are and what makes them tick. And so, you know, that's kind of why the show is starting to put its feelers out a little bit.
Okay, got you now?
Yeah.
So that seems to be doing quite well?
Sorry, yeah, absolutely. Actually, we put the book out in September. I don't know, what is this, like 7 months now? I don't know, I have no sense of time anymore. Time, it's the quickening, man. Everything's moving too fast. I have no idea. But we put the book out in September. It's still selling well on Amazon, and we just today got the ebook version up on Amazon. And the book did well enough that we put out other books. We started to put out other books. We put out a book about a month and a half ago, and we're putting out another book next week that's written by Douglas here. So we'll probably have more books coming, and but that first one's been really well. And I all the time I find myself just picking it up. The time I was working on it was just, you know, you're in work mode and you're kind of not, again, you're not processing. And then after it was done, it was like, oh my God, look at this amazing thing, and I pick it up all the time. I use it as a wonderful reference book, actually.
Okay.
No, so it's just intriguing to me how different pockets of the sync, I mean, if we call it a sync community, I mean, we all have our own point of views and things, but how different pockets are connected, but they're not as connected. And so somehow you're one of these outliers that I've always just kind of been curious about. You know, and I've experienced podcasts with you in it. But, you know, I've always just been curious, and so the 42 minutes was a good excuse to chat with you, and so I'm glad we did this.
Oh, sure. And 42 minutes is not a lot to, and it's really hard to try and explain as well. And you want to when you're trying to explain, you're trying to reach people rather than just talk about yourself, you know?
Yeah. But sometimes some of these great podcasts go on for 2 and 3 hours,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then all of a sudden it's like you're subscribing and then all of a sudden you have the backlog of 12 hours on your iPod to listen to. You're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I talked all
oh, yeah,
night.
That's a good idea.
But so when we did 42 minutes, it's like 30 is too short, but 60, you know, as far as just getting an introduction or a taste of something, you know, is a little much. But 42 feels just right to keep you anxious, but then enough breathing room to kind of see where the conversation will go. So, and then also the Douglas Adams, you know, of course, what we're going to find is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything in our 42 minutes, hopefully.
Uh-huh. Maybe we're meant to make it.
Yes. There was a great image floating around on Facebook today about how, what is it? The meaning of life is finding your gift and the purpose of life is giving it away.
Mm, I like that.
Yeah. I did too.
Yeah.
And it goes with what you were saying about, you know, what we're doing and why we're doing it. Because no one in this, I mean, no one's getting paid for any of this. And obviously, you know, it'd be fun for this to be our jobs, but we're still going to do it whether we get paid or not.
Yeah, I've always felt I couldn't do it if I got paid because I have to have absolute freedom with no pressure at all so that I can go take any route. You kind of got to stay wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something I've kind of struggled with, and I enjoyed the point that you made earlier about making things just for the hell of making them and not necessarily trying to have a particular intent or trying to solve a problem or trying to fix things, because oftentimes kind of the environmental crisis, at least we find ourselves in, is from continuing to fix problems and have a new technology and nuclear power plants, you know, to fix the energy problem, and we're kind of digging ourselves into a hole with that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that does seem to be a good antidote. I'm curious, I've seen your blog and the PDF almost kind of visual and words combination. Do you do other like painting or different types of artwork?
No, not really. I'm so busy doing this. Sometimes, occasionally I will. I think I should try a bit more, but it wouldn't be anything that anyone would consider great, you know? It's just be... yeah, nothing special. I don't have, you know, what do I do in real life? Oh, I do something special. I'm, you know, an artist or anything. I'm not. I'm just... But I think that's part of my... because I never went to university or haven't done any kind of extra studies... I find that that's paying off so well for me now because I don't have all that programming to try and break through, you know, having been taught what's right, how you should do this thing.
Sure.
My mind has stayed a lot freer. So it's been a lot freer, a lot easier to break rules, to dive into places that, yeah, not have to try and, you know, back into all that or push aside that programming.
Yeah, that does seem to be... That's something I went to school for design, and I've almost been having to unlearn what I learned in school.
Yeah.
And you brought up earlier about the trauma kind of aspect of society, and I was curious if you had looked into any stuff about birth trauma.
I haven't. Sinead, who was on the podcast we did on the weekend, has. What we sort of, one of the things that we came up with just, and again, this is how you get, you know, great discussions, is just, how much trauma comes through the family to the point where Sinead actually, and she's a psychology student, it sort of came out of her as we're having this discussion saying that families are a lot like cults. And this is something I think we're going to look at. We may well do another podcast is because we've both been, you know, since then looking into it some more. And not all, okay, looking at the family system from in the Western world is apparently, you know, great. It's sold to us through the media, you know, the family unit, how important it is. But in actual fact, so many of us come from really damaging family backgrounds. And it was Paolo, the one who does some work for Fraser X, who kind of got me thinking about this. He talked about a documentary or something he'd seen about an African tribe and how within that tribe, children were considered they belonged to the entire tribe. So they didn't belong to their parents, they belonged to the entire tribe. It was the entire tribe, in a sense, who were their parents. And so that kind of got us started thinking about, well, you look at the way families are designed now, you've just got a father and a mother, usually one who's in control. Now, if they're not happy people, and there's a lot who aren't, you've got a very small unit who have got control over children for a very long period of time. That's massive trauma conditioning. And so often, the trauma is passed down. You have cycles of trauma. So, I mean, this kind of thing, I mean, where do you fit that into the synchromistic or, you know, unit, or where do you fit? It doesn't fit anywhere. And yet it's like the hub of, this is our life. So sure. I try and bring in all this kind of thing because it matters so much.
Yeah, that is certainly something that's lost. And then even to take it to the extreme, now half the time the mother and father aren't even raising the kids and they have, you know, both have to work in order to pay the rent and feed the kids. And then the kids are, you know, put in schools and that can be, you know, another source of
school. I would say school is one of the largest trauma after the family. Then you bring in the school. The two together is just so destructive. I think schools are massively destructive in so many different ways. I have no respect for them.
There's an interesting book that I read last year. It's called Sex at Dawn, and the authors do something similar where they're challenging our culture. They're saying the things that you're not supposed to say, but they're doing it through our biology and our physiology, trying to like you solve the mystery of why, you know, what is it? Why do we have the stories that we do and then behave the way we do and how those sometimes don't necessarily play nice together? You know, so that then they're looking at it primarily through a lens of sex, where, and it goes back to what you were talking about, the idea that the family unit is our sacred unit, and it's insular, it's not tribal, and so you end up, it's not as a supportive structure as one where...
No, it's where, not. I think it's actually quite unhealthy.
Well, it has, you know, it comes down to the idea of property, where...
It's exactly.
Where, because we believe we can own property, then we abstract that to owning each other, you know, like your spouse, and then your kids are your property, and then...
Yeah.
When I got married, I refused to get a marriage license for a number of reasons. One is I refused to ask permission of a government that I don't support or even acknowledge them as a power system for permission. A license is permission. I refused to ask permission to get married. And the other thing is I sort of saw it as like a bill of sale. You know, it's like the whole idea of... My father-in-law didn't like this idea when I said it, but you know, it's like the idea of the father gives away the bride, right? It's like Pat. So this was the father's property. Now it's the husband's property. And I was like, I just don't like that.
Well, that
idea.
All just comes from the whole Kabbalistic thing where you have to get with Jehovah before you can unite with the Shekinah. So you should really consider it in that context.
Well, I asked, like. I'm not a human, you know. I asked his consent and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm still, I think, a polite and I enjoy the man's company very much. I respect him. So in that respect of, you know, hey, I'd like to, you know, in that respect, there's a conversation. But just a lot of the ideas in the ritual kind of bothered me. But that's, you know, that was okay. And then we had people say, well, then you're not really going to be married if you don't have a license and you're not having a ceremony. And I said, okay, you guys want a ceremony? We wrote our own. We made a new, you know, ritual. We made our own, and just to gather our family and friends and to do our own thing. And it was honestly incredibly beautiful. I'm sure I'm biased, but just on a personal level, that was the only way I would even do that.
Good for you. Yeah, I agree. You know, you think marriage is between, you know, three, you know, the husband, the wife, and the state. That can't be right. You know, that's not right.
Correct. Yeah. That's my own, you know, somewhat political hang up, but just on a metaphysical or personal philosophy level, just I have to think about, well, what really is this marriage? You know, what is a marriage? And we're not going to, I don't mean this in the idea of an alchemical marriage, but even if you want to take it there, this is the union of two opposites or two different energies.
I would note that you did marry a non-Joseph.
Well, that's actually, it's actually really funny. My middle name is Joseph, and her middle name, she's half Japanese, her middle name is Mari, M-A-R-I. So, Mary and Joseph right there. Keep an eye out for the Christ child.
Well, I think to some extent, though, we were talking about how the family in this fits in with kind of sync-related stuff. To some extent, I think the archetypes in the tarot and things like that, you know, you have kind of like the empress and the emperor, and like to me those are some of the biggest archetypes in the subconscious. You get kind of imprinted by that, so it would almost be interesting to see what a kind of system of mythology, I guess, when we look, if we look to like some African cultures or perhaps Native American cultures, their myths and stuff would reflect this deeper kind of underlying structure instead of just like the mother father that's so prominent in our myth.
Yeah, and especially, well, in our myth we've got, you know, Jehovah, the father god, which seems to underline the family, underline so much, you know, whether it's the head of state or whatever. We're so used to this small insular thing where you've got one head, generally one head. I know in families it can be, the mother can be the ruler, but you have one person who is in control and the others who look up to them or idolize them or obey or whatever. And I don't know, it doesn't seem healthy to me, as opposed to a wider, inclusive, like the tribal type thing.
We've talked about... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go on.
We had talked about before, just to share idea, that I've heard of 2012 as the end of history, and what we consider history to be his story, it's always a tale of men going out and conquering and fighting and killing each other, and who was kind of the top dog, or who was, you know, the Jehovah kind of resonating character, who was the boss. And before that, there was more of a female-centric goddess worship, kind of tribal organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we're like, well, if 2012 is the end of history, you know, what comes after, at the end of his story? You know, like maybe it's the end of this war-like, story. And I guess the answer would be something like our story, or more of a balanced kind of group story instead of that.
Well, I mean, and that's a lovely idea. It's not looking that way at the moment, you know, it's not looking in terms of, it does look like, as far as the his story, it can't really go much further, you know, the way this is
right.
Kind of like this duality, the pendulum swings one way, it's surely we're at the maximum, you know, point of the pendulum now with the his story, and there isn't anywhere further it can go, you know, even if it wants to.
Well, I think it's ironic, Fukuyama claimed that after the Berlin Wall came down, that was the end of history. Like, the end of history happened, like, and this was before
everything, you know, in the last little bit of time, 9/11 and everything had happened, but this guy claimed the end of history. And we all bought into that.
Well, we bought into so many different things. I mean, I think when you get into whatever this kind of movement, and there's like different variations of it, because you feel like you've almost come home at first, you know? People are kind of talking your language, they're speaking of things that you can really associate with. You really, at first, buy into it very heavily, you know? And then it seems to me there needs to come a point, though, where you step back. Because otherwise you're just, like we're talking on the show, you just keep absorbing the information. You just keep eating and eating and eating. I've likened it to, in terms of being on a, when you first come across all this kind of thing, it's like you get on a ferry. So you have the ferryman. The ferryman takes you somewhere. But you have to get off the ferry, you know, because if you don't, well, you know, Charon was the ferryman. You don't want to stay on his boat, you know, forever. So you have to develop your own thought processes, your own, choose your path that you're going to take. You know, that's that kind of standing up and choosing, right, I'm going down this path. I think a lot of the problem with a lot of people within this kind of movement, this kind of, you know, the people that we reach is that they are not actually using their own two feet to walk somewhere. They kind of want to sit on the back of, you know, people who do the work or do the research and just be fed information and but go nowhere.
Yeah, Joseph Campbell in his interpretation of the Grail legends makes a good point about, they say that you should go your own way and just enter the forest where it's darkest and there can't be a path there, because if there is a path, it's someone else's path. It's a path that other people's feet have worn and isn't necessarily your own path. And you do run the risk of, you know, getting cut up by thorns and experiencing some pain if you are going to just blaze your own trail, but I think that's part of the fun of it.
Oh, absolutely. What's a few thorns? You can't beat it. You know, that's why I don't actually read other people's work anymore, because I have too much fun playing with ideas myself. If something comes across my path in my researches, I will read it, but I don't go looking for anyone else to provide me with that initial impetus, because there's so much out there already, and then there's so much you can just take from your own life, which I just think is, I love that, you know? And synchronicity means things to me when it appears in my own life and has significance, personal significance to me. Then I feel, okay, I appreciate this. Again, I don't base everything on it, but I take it as a strong, often it's a strong pointer, but always at the same time ready to step away from it if I don't feel good about it.
It's interesting. Did you watch the show Lost at all?
No.
Because it seemed like there was a little bit of that where synchronicity would happen, and it wasn't necessarily always good, and so it wasn't necessarily always good for them to, you know, read the signs. Like one character,
yeah,
John, it seemed like, yep, John Locke was always being led into situations where he would just get so angry. It's like, but I'm following the signs. You know, and so that poses an interesting thought about the nature of synchronicity, because it is playful, but it can be kind of treacherous, I guess. It leads you down into a rabbit hole that you can't get out of.
Absolutely. So I think on top of, you know, synchronicity is, so you've got your normal life or whatever, then synchronicity is the next step up, if you want to put it that way. And then after that, for me, is intuition. So I'm a lot more stronger on my own physical gut feeling. So there will be times when I'm looking into something and I feel physically sick. So I'm taking that as, well, get out of there, just move a step away from that. So that's something physically embodied in me. I will always take that over any synchronicity any day, because synchronicity is coming in from the outside.
You know, there's something I've heard mentioned a lot when in terms of synchronicity is the idea of an element of a trickster. And of course, you know, throughout the ages, there are elements of a trickster god, or even like these different gods giving false signs, you know, sort of playing with the human chessboard, if you will. Personally, I've never experienced synchronicity as something that I thought was malicious or leading me astray. I just can't say I've ever experienced it, but I have heard a lot of people say that. Do you think when Doug used the phrase, you know, synchronicity is playful, do you think there is a crossover with playful and the trickster?
Yeah, it could well be. There's a couple of times, because at first I was so into it and it was just absolutely go with it, that there was a couple of dark things, and it's because that happened, it was one of the reasons I stepped back from it, because I was like, oh, I don't like this is creepy. So I stepped back, and I'm very glad that I stepped back, because I feel like I was like a little puppy dog, you know? It was just like, you know, and someone was throwing me treats, and I was just like, oh, wow, oh, wow, wow. So when that happens, like, oh, this, I don't like this. This is, creeping me out a bit. So I stepped back, and then I realized, well, I need to step back because I need to be in the driving seat. I can't let synchronicity be dictating where I go, what I do. I have to be in charge, in a sense, in the driving seat, or maybe even sometimes a little bit in the navigator seat, because I think maybe the driving seat it's almost something organic. We're maybe more the navigator. So that's our consciousness choosing, okay, saying now go down this path. Okay, we want to go in that direction. So more of using our conscious awareness to decide where we want to go. And if on that path, then we meet synchronicity, that's great, but still, does that fit with the direction that we're choosing to go in? And we are not obliged to follow synchronicity. It's a tool. Just like when I used to read tarot cards, they were a tool. I never treated them with utmost respect. You know, I didn't put them in a little velvet bag and, you know, put them somewhere special, because I needed to be the one, I'm not saying in charge, but in control, the one who was asking the questions, the one who was, they were a tool. I couldn't put them in the center of my life. They're just a tool.
That's really funny, because I don't want to, you know, just chew your ear off, just give an, basically I've been working on a story where something I was sort of researching was these different type of time cycles and ways of measuring them. And of course there's like the I Ching with its 64, and there's the Tarot with the 78. And as I was sort of playing with some of these ideas and just trying to figure out how, you know, what was more accurate as a map of time cycles, I started thinking about the idea of using it as a story device. I noticed in a few movies where they framed the movie around the Tarot. I mean, even as recently as a few weeks ago, I watched Pee Wee's Playhouse. Pee Wee's Big Adventure. I hadn't watched in years. And I was like, oh my God, it is explicitly stating out the 22 trumps of the Tarot. It's really explicit. And Jason, you would enjoy it.
Make a post about it, man.
I know, I've just been really busy, but but it's anyway, something that I thought about was this idea of devising a story, trying to use all 78 cards, and then I stumbled across how Philip K. Dick had used the I Ching when he was writing Man in High Castle, and that he would kind of let the plot progress with the castings of I Ching. I had this idea I was going to write a story, the story that I'd already kind of started just a little bit, and had the idea that I was going to frame it around each of the 78 cards. And then, since I had already written five pages of it, I realized, well, okay, I'm going to pick the five cards that I think apply to these, and then I'll pick random from there. And just as soon as I started that, I had the idea that, well, every now and then I would think I would have to sort of force the hand a little bit. And like you said, it's the idea of taking fate into your own hands there's one thing to be respectful if you're honestly trying to map out how a sort of random story would play out and all that sort of stuff. But just as in my own life, I wouldn't let this dictate if I drew a tarot card. I wouldn't let it say, oh, I guess I'm not going, don't cross the street at 3 p.m. or something. There's a certain element of you step in and you're in control. And I, just on a totally creative writing standpoint, I wanted to stay true to the randomness of it. And I thought, well, every now and then, it's appropriate in life and in art, even on an experiment like this, to step in and say, well, no, I think this is what has to happen next, and to apply that to a certain card. So this was just something I was kind of going over in my head very recently. And again, it's the idea of respectfulness to the artwork, to the experiment, to everything. But the answer I just felt really solid in my heart and in my gut was that, no, I mean, there's a time and a place to take fate into your own hands. And Jason had actually, we were speaking, and he mentioned, used almost the exact same phrase. And I was like, yeah, okay, it just seems right. Like you said, don't let synchronicity rule you. You can use it as a tool, but it should never dictate your life. You still need to be the main navigator or agent of your own destiny.
Absolutely. It's a tool. It comes in. It's of use. But, yeah, and I think this is something that, you know, so many people are not understanding how important it is to take their lives back, you know, because, yeah, they're waiting for to see what happens in 2012. They're waiting to see if they just read this, if they just understand this, while their life just turns to custard or something. There's nothing there. They're losing it. You've got to be living it. And that's, you know, something in the real life. You know, it isn't an idea. All these things are, yeah, they're tools or they're toys. That's another thing. I have no hesitation in taking anything and playing with it. I don't care whether it's the gods. No problem. For me, the most sacred thing is human beings and life, this planet. So anything that goes against that, like I said to Doug, you know, I know he said he was looking into Persephone, but I wouldn't think twice about mopping the floor with her if I needed to. Because the most important thing to me is humanity, it's life. It's us being able to live. And this is a thing that just seems we're not doing, you know? So I won't help. Nothing gets held more sacred than that. And so you're no different to a child who plays with whatever. They don't know that, oh, they shouldn't play with this, or they should. They take a set of tarot cards and quite happily, you know, get their crayons and draw all over them. And are they sinning? No. They're playing. You know, they're exploring, they're learning. What's more important, the child or the tarot card, the child or the synchronicity, the child or whatever? You know, there's no comparison.
The devil's advocate argument, of course, would be the child could be playing with fire.
Sorry, what was that bit?
Just saying that the devil's advocate argument could be that the child is playing with fire. You know, you said the child doesn't know what it's playing with. I don't stand by that argument. I'm just saying that would, of course, be the argument that could be made there.
Oh, sure. And again, you know, this is provocation. What I say is true. How do I know? I don't know. This is how I work. This is where I took my stand. So, no, the most important thing is life, humanity living, being what they're meant to be, creators. So everything else is secondary to that.
Well, Persephone is my life principle. She's the goddess of the crops, the plant spirit. So
yeah,
there's no contradiction there.
Yeah, it just depends which way you look on it. You know, that whole the Eleusinian mystery, that's a real dark thing to me. Because if someone speaks about what they saw, you're going to kill them. See, there again is that, oh, humanity can just be cut down because we mustn't upset the gods. You know, I can't stand by anything that is against life. And I just find for me, so often the gods, religion, everything, it's all against life.
Justin, you had made a similar point last summer, the idea of everyone kind of waiting for 2012, waiting to see how it would play out, instead of actually seizing the moment and letting it be that, you know, you make it happen now. Wait, you know, so waiting for a shift you say, we can make this shift right now. We don't have to wait till any specific date, or you're constantly being told it's going to happen later. Oh, it'll happen in 2012. It'll happen. So instead of waiting to actually seize it, do it yourself.
Yeah, I've almost thought recently as a joke that we should go ahead and just start like a 2014 thing or something like that.
Well, I've done that.
Sorry?
My fuck this date in 2013. I moved it a year and a day ahead, my mobile phone.
Yeah. But we could start the next big, you know, the used bookstores are going to be flooded with 2012 books in about six or 7 months from now. We could go ahead and start writing the 2014 books and be like, you know, well, the end of the such and such, you know, was 2014. But yeah, people always kind of look for a good excuse not to have to do the heavy lifting now. And yeah, I think we're all kind of on the same page about that. But you know, and then the contradiction is that there does seem to be some sort of quickening and something happening. And as we were talking about from a conspiratorial level, there really is kind of a clamping down going on, almost like they're trying to get ready for something. You know, I'm living out here in Oakland, and I don't know what you guys have seen since you're not in the area, but the amount of force they've used on the Occupy Oakland protesters out here has been pretty wild. It's been some of the most dramatic kind of Occupy stuff going on. As far as like the police crackdown and SWAT teams and like hundreds of police and them shooting tear gas and whatnot.
Yeah, I saw images of that today.
Yeah, so there's just been helicopters flying around all day because it's May Day or whatnot.
Oh, okay.
Right. People were going to go on strike today.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's such a play on all this stuff because of the significance of May Day just all across the board as a Beltane and, you know, you name it. But I saw, like, the posters here in New York, I saw some stickers of people showing this smashed clock, and it said, like, for the general strike. And what I thought was interesting is I sort of saw it as like you talked about the end of history. This smashed clock seemed to me as a thing of like a, you know, trying to kill Saturn, trying to, you know, stop time or stop the clock.
But it's funny because we, like Andras and I would argue that we're just smashing the idol, that we don't have a real relationship to time. We have a relationship to the clock. The clock is just time abstracted. And that real time is more of the cyclical, seasonal, you know, the breathing of the light and the dark and the seasons.
Yeah, that's the same thing we were talking before, but there's a natural progression, a natural cycle to life.
Right.
was hoping it was a lie. Ones, all in a dream, all